In a very long while, he relaxed. Still dripping sweat, he set himself up in Manager Art Howe's empty office, with the television switched on. 19 games into a winning streak, up 11-0 against one of the worst teams in baseball, with one of the best pitchers in baseball still on the mound for the Oakland A's, this one game appeared safe to watch. It wasn't going to violate the laws of probability. It wasn't going to drive him mad and cause him to do something he might later regret. At that moment, Billy Bean was so at peace with his world that he let me into it. His feet were up on Art Howe's formica desk. He was feeling detached, expansive, delighted and delightful. This was the way he felt most of the time. This was the way he almost always handled himself away from baseball. He had, he confessed, expressed his concern when he saw that Art Howe had written John Mabry's name on the lineup card, where Scott Hatterberg's should have been. It was a shame for Hatterberg, I thought. Here he's been performing these valuable and rather selfless services to the Oakland A's offense, and the one game the world will watch, he isn't allowed to play. Art explained to Billy that Hatterberg had never faced Kansas City's ace, Paul Byrd. Mabry, on the other hand, not only had hit Byrd hard, but claimed to be able to see him tipping his pitches. That is, Mabry could guess what Byrd was about to throw. Billy now says he deferred to Art's judgment, as if deferring to Art's judgment comes naturally to him. Mabry promptly made Art Howe look like a genius. He'd driven in one run with a single up the middle in the 6-run first inning, and helped to chase Byrd from the game. Then in the second inning, he'd whacked a solo home run. With a score 11-0 and Tim Hudson still carving up the Royals' lineup, the absence of Scott Hatterberg from the lineup is a distant memory. Billy Bean is right to feel his usual self. The odds of something going wrong are ridiculously small. He calls his daughter Casey, now 14 years old and still living in Southern California. "Hey, Casey, you watching the game?" Pause. "American Idol? You're watching American Idol?" Casey is watching American Idol. He tells Casey the news. The team is winning big. A nation of baseball fans is watching. Teases her a bit and lets her go. Billy Bean should always be so calm during his team's games. If he believes what he claims to believe, that the game can be reduced to a social science, that it is simply a matter of figuring out the odds and exploiting the laws of probability, that baseball players follow strikingly predictable patterns, then there is no point in being anything but calm. To get worked up over plays or even games is as unproductive as a casino manager worrying over the outcomes of individual pulls of the slot machines. Billy as good as makes this point now by pointing at the TV where Eric Chavez, having just made a difficult defensive play look routine, sheepishly starts kicking the dirt in front of him. "He's almost afraid to acknowledge how good he really is," says Billy. "And here's the thing. He's 24 years old. You know, if he's here now," he holds his hands at his chest, "he'll wind up here." He raises his hand over his head. "You could make a case that Chavy is the most naturally gifted player in the game." I ask him to make the case, and in his current detached mood, he's more than happy to. Up 11-0 against a sorry club, he's reveling in the objective, scientific spirit. "Age is such a critical factor in evaluating guys," he says, then plucks the Oakland A's media guide off Art Howe's bookshelf. "Here. Chavy is 24. The season isn't over. He's got 31 homers, 28 doubles, 55 walks, a .283 batting average, and a .353 on-base percentage. Who do you want to compare him to?" "Jason Giambi," I say. "All right," as he pulls out the New York Yankees media guide. "But I know the answer to this already because I already did it." He finds Giambi's career statistics. When Jason was 24 years old, he spent half the year in Edmonton on a AAA team. In the half he was in the big leagues, he hit 6 homers, drew 28 walks, and hit .256. Who else? "Barry Bonds," I say. Across the bay, Bonds is making the argument every night that he is the finest hitter who ever played the game. "That's hard," he says. Bonds has reached that level where even talent can't take you. But okay, let's take Bonds. He grabs a San Francisco Giants media guide. I know what it's going to show because I did this with him, too. Bonds was born in 1964. In 1988, he hit .283 with 24 homers, 72 walks, and 30 doubles. That gives you some idea of how good Xavi is. Who else? He asks. But before I can think of anyone else, he says, let's try A-Rod. No one had a quicker start than A-Rod. He pulls the Texas Rangers media guide. A-Rod was 24 in 1999. In 1999, he hit .285 with 25 doubles, 42 homers, and 111 runs batted in. He looks up. That compares well enough, but then there's defense. Xavi is the best fielding third baseman in the game. A-Rod isn't the best fielding shortstop. I'm still having trouble getting my mind around the notion of making such forecasts about human beings, and I say as much. My problem can be simply put. Every player is different. Each player must be viewed as a special case. The sample size is always one. His answer is equally simple. Baseball players follow similar patterns, and these patterns are etched in the record books. Of course, every so often some player may fail to embrace his statistical destiny, but on a team of 25 players, the statistical aberrations will tend to cancel each other out. And most of them will conform fairly exactly to his expectations. About Eric Chavez's career, for instance, he has not the slightest doubt. The only thing that will stop Xavi is if he gets bored, he says. People don't understand that. He continues to frustrate people who take him out of context. He is 24 years old. What he's done at 24, no one has done. Health permitted, his whole career is a lock. I mentioned that there are times when Billy is one of the people Xavi frustrates. Xavi, like Miguel Tejada, is Mr. Swing at everything. In his current mood, Billy waves the objection aside. He can't understand how I can be so intolerant. Xavi's young, he says. He's good-looking. He's a millionaire. He kind of owes it to himself to swing at everything. What were you like when you were 24? This was the character whose behavior was consistent with the way he said he wanted to run his baseball team. Rationally. Scientifically. This was the objective Billy Bean, the general manager who was certain that you don't change guys, they are who they are, who will describe his job as a soapbox derby. You build the car in the beginning of the year, and after that, all you do is push it down the hill. To this Billy Bean's way of thinking, there was no point in meddling with the science experiment. There was no point in trying to get inside players' heads, for instance, to reshape their approach to the game. They will be who they will be. When you listen to the objective Billy Bean talk about his players, you begin to wonder if baseball players have free will. But there is another less objective Billy Bean. And in the top of the fourth inning, when Miguel Tejada drops a routine inning-ending double play throw from second baseman Mark Ellis, the other Billy Bean awakens from his slumber. Even as the Royals score 5 runs they shouldn't have, Billy remains calm. After all, it's still 11-5, and Tim Hudson is still pitching. But he's on alert. He begins to talk about his players in a different way. And he allows me to see that the science experiment is messier than the chief scientist usually is willing to admit. In the Oakland fourth, center fielder Terrence Long hits a grounder back to the pitcher and runs hard down the first base line. This is new. Heretofore, when Terrence Long is grounded out, he has trotted down the line with supreme indifference to public opinion. Too young to know that you are what you pretend to be, Terrence Long has nearly perfected the art of seeming not to care. As it happens, a few days ago, Terrence walked out into the player's parking lot and discovered that someone had egged his car. Hearing of the incident, Billy stopped by Terrence's locker and told him that he'd had an email from the culprit, an A's fan, who said he was furious that he'd paid money to watch Terrence Long jog the bases. The effect on Terrence Long was immediate. He went from jogging to first on a routine ground out to running as fast as he can until the first moment he can stop without pissing off Billy Bean. As he sprints down the line, Billy says that Terrence's real problem is his own self-doubt, exacerbated by the media. That's one of the mistakes that young players make. They actually read the papers. In the Oakland fifth, with the score still 11-5, Ramon Hernandez leads off. Twice in the first four innings, the Oakland catcher has taken outside fastballs and driven doubles to the opposite field. This is new. All season long, Ramon Hernandez has been trying and failing to pull outside fastballs. He's been a complete bust on offense and failed to conform to the Oakland A's front office's greater expectations of him. As it happens, the other day, Billy stopped by Ramon Hernandez's locker and made a bet with him. Each time he went the opposite way with an outside pitch, Billy would pay him $50. Each time he tried to pull an outside pitch, he'd pay Billy $50. The point of the exercise, Billy now says, is it gives me an excuse to henpeck Ramon. It's a subversive way for me to keep nagging the shit out of him without him knowing it. Most of the players who pass across the television screen on this historic evening have been on the receiving end of Billy Bean's subtle attempts to manipulate their behavior. He claims there is no point in trying to change people, and then he goes ahead and tries to change them anyway. He knows most of his players better than he would ever allow himself to be known by them, and while that is not saying very much, it still says something. "Look at Miggy's face," he says at the end of the sixth inning. The television camera is on Tejada in the dugout, looking surprisingly glum. He's the only guy in the lineup without a hit. This is what happens with younger players. They want to do too much. Watch him. He'll try to do more than he should. And sure enough, after Tim Hudson gets into trouble and Chad Bradford is called in from the bullpen, he does. When Chad Bradford is in the bullpen, he often thinks about his father. It helps put whatever pressure he's feeling into perspective. The doctors had told his father he'd never walk again, and the man had not only walked, he'd worked, and not only worked, but played catch. If his father could do that, how hard was this? The thought usually made him feel better, but tonight, with so much on the line, it doesn't. He's feeling like a different pitcher than he was just a few weeks ago. Before the trouble started, he'd been exactly as effective as Paul DePodesta's computer had predicted he would be. For nearly two full seasons, he's been living his dream. Chad himself had not quite believed it when, before the 2001 season, just after his back surgery, Billy Bean called him to tell him that he had traded for him with a view to him becoming the critical middle reliever in the Oakland A's big league bullpen. Billy told Chad the statistics he thought he was capable of generating, and even Chad thought they were a stretch. Amazingly, to Chad, he'd done almost exactly what Billy Bean predicted he would do. "It's like the guy knows what's going to happen before it happens," said Chad. Now he's unsure that Billy Bean's faith in him is justified. He pulls his cap down over his eyes and walks briskly towards the mound, reaching it in exactly the same number of steps he always does. Outside, everything looked the same. Inside, everything felt different. A few weeks ago, when he looked in to take the signal from the catcher, he was oblivious to his surroundings. He'd be repeating to himself his usual phrase to shut down his mind to the pressure. Make your pitch. Make your pitch. Make your pitch. Tonight, he wasn't oblivious. Tonight, as he leaned in, he was aware of everything. The crowd noise, the signs, the national audience, and a new mantra now running through his head. Don't fuck this up. Don't fuck this up. Don't fuck this up. He's having the worst slump in his entire professional career, and while it isn't actually all that bad a slump, one bad outing in Yankee Stadium, another in Fenway Park, he has no ability to put it into perspective. On his bookshelf at home, there were two books side by side, tattered by his constant use of them. One was The Mental Game of Baseball. The other was the Bible. He has a favorite passage, Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. It's giving him no solace. A few nights before, after another nerve-wracking outing, he'd called his wife Jenny, who had taken the kids back to Byram for the start of the school year, and said, "I don't think I can do this anymore." The Oakland A's pitching coach, Rick Peterson, thinks that Chad's problems began in early August, when ESPN announcer Jeff Brantley had come into Oakland and done a piece on him, identifying Chad on national television as one of the premier setup men in the game. Attention disturbed Chad's concentration. Peterson had been critical to Oakland's pitching success. He kept the Oakland pitchers healthy, and in some cases he also kept them focused. He was fond of saying that if you have 12 different pitchers, you've got to speak 12 different languages. The difference between Chad and the other pitchers was that the other's language had words for the phrase, "I belong in the big leagues." Chad's language lacked the vocabulary of personal defiance, of self-confidence. Throughout his career, Chad had responded to trouble not by looking inside himself to see what was there, but by dropping his point of release lower to the ground. His knuckles now scrape the dirt when he throws. "He's got nowhere to go," said Peterson, "unless he throws upside down." His pitching coach is trying to teach Chad how to go inside. After one of his weak outings, when he was looking lost, Peterson had made him sit down and watch tape of himself slicing and dicing big league hitters for the first 5 months of the season. As Chad watched the tape of his old self, Peterson made his point. "You're a Christian, right, Chad?"
"Yeah."
"You believe in Jesus?"
"Yeah."
"Have you ever seen him?"
"No, I've never seen him."
"Ever seen yourself get hitters out?"
"Yeah."
"So why the fuck do you have faith in Jesus when you never seen him, but you don't have faith in your ability to get hitters out when you get hitters out all the time?"
His coach left him with that thought. Chad sat there and said to himself, "Okay, that makes sense." But a little while later, the doubts returned. For his entire career, hardly anyone has believed in him, and now that they do, he can't quite believe in himself. "It's my greatest weakness," he said. "I have zero self-confidence. The only way I can explain it is that I'm not the guy who throws 95 miles an hour. The guy who throws 95 can always see his talent. But I don't have that. My stuff depends on deception. For it to work, there's so much that has to go right. When it starts not going right, I think, oh my gosh, I hope I can keep fooling him. Then I start to ask, how much longer can I keep fooling him?" He's having, with him, there isn't a more accurate way to put it, a crisis of faith. When he knows, he always hits his spots. When he hopes, he never does. And he's now just hoping. Oblivious to how good he is susceptible to the argument that his success is a trick, or a fluke, or a spell that at any moment might break. He doesn't much care that he is, for the first time in his miraculous career, the only one still making this argument. That night in early September, he's fighting himself more fiercely than ever before. Billy Bean knows it. His cheap, out-getting machine has a programming glitch. He has no idea how to fix it, how to get inside Chad Bradford's head. Sloth, indolence, a lack of discipline, an insufficient fear of management. These problems Billy knows how to attack. Insecurity is beyond him. If he knew how to solve the problem, he might be finishing up his playing career and preparing himself for election to the Hall of Fame. But he still doesn't know, and it worries him. Chad doesn't know that he will retire batters at such a predictable rate in such a predictable way that he might as well be a robot. As a result, he might not do it. Billy Bean only watches all of what happens next because he somehow allowed himself to be trapped watching the game with me. What happens next is that Chad Bradford shows the world how quickly a big lead in baseball can be lost. He gets the final out in the seventh inning on a ground ball. The eighth inning is the problem. Art Howe allows Chad to return to the mound to face a series of left-handed hitters. "I'm glad Art's leaving him in," says Billy. "He's wasted if you only use him to get an out." I ask if it worries him that Chad relies so heavily on faith, that Chad's genuine, understandable belief that the good Lord must be responsible for his fantastic ability to get big league hitters out leaves him open to the suspicion that the good Lord might have changed his mind.
No, says Billy. I'm a believer, too. I just happen to believe in the power of the ground ball.
In nearly 70 relief appearances this year, Chad Bradford has walked exactly 10 batters, about one every 30 he has faced. He opens the eighth inning by walking Brent Main. As Main trots down to first base, the Oakland crowd stirs and hollers. Someone from the center field bleachers hurls a roll of toilet paper onto the field. It takes a minute to clear, leaving Chad time with his hellish thoughts. When play resumes, 55,000 people rise up and bang and shout, perhaps thinking this will help Chad to settle down. Why should noise have any more effect on the hitter than the pitcher, says Billy, a bit testily. If you're playing away, you just pretend they're cheering for you. Chad walks the second hitter, D. Brown. It's the first time all year he's walked two batters in a row. The TV cameras pan to Miguel Tejada and second baseman Mark Ellis, conferring behind their gloves. In the last 10 years, guys started covering their lips with their gloves, snaps Billy. I've never known a single lip reader in baseball. What, has there been a rash of lip reading I don't know about? The third batter, Nefi Perez, hits a slow ground ball to the second baseman. John Mabry, playing first, races across and cuts it off. Chad just stands on the mound and watches the play develop. By the time it has, it's too late for him to cover first base. The bases are now loaded with nobody out. Another roll of toilet paper streams from the bleachers into center field. The crowd is on its feet, making more noise than ever, still thinking, Lord knows why, that their attention is what Chad Bradford needs to get him through his troubles. Billy stares at the television with disgust, like a theater critic being forced to watch a mangled interpretation of Hamlet. I can't believe I have to sit here and watch this shit, he says. He pulls his little white box onto the desk in front of him. Its plastic shine has been rubbed dull. I would be dying right now if I was walking around watching this, he says. He's fantasizing. If I hadn't trapped him with the TV inside this office, he would be out in the parking lot, marching around, glancing every 5 seconds at the white box. He'd rather be dying out there than whatever he's doing in here. The next batter, Luis Ordaz, is the one who makes good on Billy's prediction about Miguel Tejada. Watch him. He'll try to do too much. Ordaz hits a routine ground ball to Tejada's right. Instead of making the routine play, the force at third, Tejada tries to make the acrobatic one, the force at home. His leaping throw bounces in the dirt in front of Ramon Hernandez, and all runners are safe. 11-6. Bases still loaded, nobody yet out. Art Howe virtually leaps out of the dugout to yank Chad from the game. On his way to his seat on the bench, Chad stares at the ground and works to remain expressionless. He came in with a 6-run lead. He leaves with the tying run in the on-deck circle. The ball never left the infield. Jesus Christ, what a fucking embarrassment, says Billy. He reaches under the desk and extracts a canister of Copenhagen. He jams the chaw into his upper lip. Why am I even watching this shit? The new pitcher, Ricardo Rincon, gets 2 quick outs and gives up just 1 run on a sacrifice fly. 11-7. With 2 outs and runners on first and third, Art Howe walks out yet again. This time he calls for right-hander Jeff Tam, newly arrived from AAA, to face the right-handed Mike Sweeney, who is, at the moment, leading the American League in hitting. Fuck, says Billy. Why? They all take this lefty-righty shit too far. What's wrong with leaving Rincon in? Tam had 2 years in the A's bullpen where he played the role now played by Chad Bradford. There was a time when Ron Washington, the infield coach, took to calling Tam toilet paper, because he's always cleaning up everybody else's shit. But something happened, either in Tam's head or in his delivery, and for the past 2 years he hasn't been the same guy. Relievers are like volatile stocks, Billy says. They're the one asset you need to watch closely and trade for quick profits. As his manager and reliever confer, Billy Bean looks at me apologetically. In under 45 minutes, he's passed from detachment to interest, from interest to irritation, from irritation to anger, and is now obviously on the brink of rage. He's embarrassed by his emotions, but not enough to control them. "All right," he finally says, "you'll have to excuse me. I'm going to have to pace around here." With that, he walks out into the clubhouse, closing the door behind him, and begins to storm around. Past the trainer's room where poor Tim Hudson, who must be wondering what he needs to do to get a win, is having heat applied to his shoulder. Past Scott Hatterberg and Greg Myers, the two lefties on the bench who had thought they had the night off, rushing back through the clubhouse to the batting cage to take some practice swings in case they're asked to pinch hit. And finally, past the video room where Paul De Podesta stews on the improbability of the evening. Paul already has calculated the odds of winning 20 games in a row. He puts them at 14 in a million. Now he's calculating the odds of losing an 11-run lead. It may not be 14 in a million, but it's close. In his 1983 abstract, Bill James had contemplated tonight's game. James had observed in baseball what he called a law of competitive balance. "There exists in the world a negative momentum," he wrote, "which acts constantly to reduce the differences between strong teams and weak teams, teams which are ahead and teams which are behind, or good players and poor players. The corollaries are: 1. Every form of strength covers one weakness and creates another, and therefore every form of strength is also a form of weakness, and every weakness a strength. 2. The balance of strategies always favors the team which is behind. 3. Psychology tends to pull the winners down and push the losers upwards." More metaphysics than physics, it was as true of people as it was of baseball teams. People who want very badly to win and to be seen to have won enjoy a tactical advantage over people who don't. That very desire, tantamount to a need, is also a weakness. In Billy Beane, the trait is so pronounced that it is not merely a weakness, it is a curse. When play resumes, Jeff Tam and Mike Sweeney fight a great battle. On the 10th pitch of the at-bat, after fouling off 4 pitches with Superman swings, Sweeney takes a slider from Tam and golfs it off the 1-800 bar none sign, just over the left field wall. 11-10. Something big crashes in the clubhouse. On the TV over Art Howe's desk, Art himself is again on his way to the mound to replace Jeff Tam with a lefty named Micah Bowie. Mike Sweeney enthusiastically explains to his teammates in the Kansas City dugout how he thought his home run was a foul ball. The announcers say what a pity it is that Miguel Tejada tried to do too much with the routine ground ball to third. Had he not, the A's would be out of the inning. Billy bursts back in the room, cheeks red, teeth black. "Fucking Tam," he says. "He thinks he's going to fool the best hitter in the league with his slider." He mutes the television, grabs his tin of Copenhagen, and vanishes, leaving me to watch the game alone in his manager's office. The manager's office is now completely silent. The 55,000 people outside are making about as much noise as 55,000 people can make, but none of it reaches this benighted place. Pity, Art Howe. What little he has done to make the office a home suggests a view of the world so different from Billy Beane's that it's a wonder he's kept his job as long as he has. There's a framed aphorism called the Optimist's Creed. There is a plaque containing the wisdom of Vince Lombardi. There is an empty coffee pot with a canister of non-dairy creamer. Behind the manager's white Formica desk is a sign that says, "Thank you for not smoking." There are photos that hint at a fealty to baseball's mystique. One of Art standing on the dugout steps, another of Art and Cal Ripken, signed by Ripken. On the television, Art maintains his stoical expression. Beneath him flashes the news that no Athletics team has lost an 11-run lead since the Philadelphia A's lost one to the St. Louis Browns in 1936. Baseball has so much history and tradition. You can respect it, or you can exploit it for profit, but it's still being made all over the place, all the time. Micah Bowie gets the final out in the Kansas City eighth, and the A's go quickly in their half. In the top of the ninth, facing closer Billy Koch, the Royals get a man as far as second base. With two outs and two strikes against a weak hitter, Luis Alicea, the game, once again, looks over. Then Alicea lines a single into left center. 11-11. From somewhere in the clubhouse, I hear a sharp cry, then the clatter of metal on metal. I open Art Howe's door to sneak a peek and spot Scott Hatterberg running from the batting cage to the tunnel that leads to the Oakland dugout. Hatterberg isn't particularly ready to play. He's in the wrong state of mind and carrying the wrong bat. After Art Howe told him he wasn't playing tonight, he'd poured himself a cup of coffee, then another. He'd sat down briefly and chatted with some guy he'd never met and whose name he couldn't remember, who wanted to show him some bats he had handcrafted. Hatterberg had picked out one of the guy's bats, a shiny black maple one with a white ring around its neck. He liked the feel of it. Like most of the players, Hatterberg, as a minor leaguer, had signed a contract with the Louisville Slugger Company, in which he agreed to use only the company's bats. All but certain that he would not play tonight, he had taken his contraband bat with him to the dugout. By the time the score was 11-0, certain that he would never play, he had the bat between his knees and four cups of coffee in his bloodstream. He is, by the bottom of the ninth, chemically altered. He's also holding a bat he's never hit with. The score remains 11-11. The Kansas City closer, Jason Grimsley, is on the mound, throwing his usual blazing sinkers. Jermaine Dye flies to right for the first out. The television camera pans the A's dugout, and from their expressions you can see that a lot of the players think the game is as good as lost. In losing an 11-run lead, they'd lost more than that. They look as if they know the last good thing already has happened to them. Art Howe tells Scott Hatterberg to grab a bat. He's pinch-hitting. Hatterberg grabs the bat given to him by the anonymous craftsman. It violates the contract he signed as a minor leaguer with the Louisville Slugger Company, but what the hell. He had faced Grimsley just 2 days before in a similar situation. Tie game, bottom of the ninth, but that time there were men on base. He didn't need to watch tape tonight. With a pitcher like Grimsley, you always know what you'll be getting. 96-mile-per-hour heat. You also usually know where you'll be getting it. At the bottom of or just below the strike zone. 2 days ago, Grimsley had thrown him six straight sinking fastballs down and away. With two strikes on him, Hatterberg had swung at the last of them and hit a weak ground ball to second base. Miguel Tejada had followed him with a game-winning single up the middle. As disappointing as that experience had been, it now served a purpose. He'd seen six pitches from Jason Grimsley. He's gathered his information. He knew that, if at all possible, he shouldn't fool around with Grimsley's low sinkers. Tonight, as he steps into the box, he promises himself that he won't swing at anything down in the zone until he has two strikes. He'll wait for what he wants until he has no choice but to accept whatever happens to be coming. He's looking for something up, something he can drive for a double and get himself in scoring position. He settles into his usual open stance and waggles the shiny black contraband bat back and forth through the zone, like a golfer on the first tee. As Grimsley comes into the stretch, his face contorts in the most unsettling way. He actually grins as he pitches, and it's not a friendly grin. It's the grin of a man who enjoys pulling wings off flies. The effect on the TV viewer is unnerving. But Hattie doesn't see Grimsley's face. He's gazing at the general area where he expects the ball to leave Grimsley's hand. He needs to see just one pitch to get his timing down. He's thinking, if I can lay off the first pitch, I might get a pitch up in the zone. Over and over, he's telling himself, lay off the first pitch. The man who will this year lead the entire American League in laying off first pitches feels he needs to give himself a pep talk to lay off the first pitch. It must be the caffeine. He lays off the first pitch. It's a ball, just low. Another round of horrible facial expressions, and Grimsley's ready again. The second pitch is another fastball, but it's high in the strike zone. Hattie takes his short swing, The ball finds the barrel of his bat and rockets into deep right center field. He leaves the batter's box in a crouching run. He's moving just as fast as he does when he hits a slow roller to the third baseman. He doesn't see Grimsley raging. He doesn't hear 55,000 fans erupting. He doesn't notice the first baseman turning to leave the field. He doesn't know that there's a fellow from Cooperstown following him around the bases, picking them up, and will soon come looking for his bat. The only one in the entire Coliseum who does not know where the ball is going is the man who hit it. Scott Hatterberg alone watches the ball soar through the late night air with something like detachment. The ball doesn't just leave the park. It lands high up in the stands, 50 feet or so beyond the 362 sign in deep right center field. When he's finally certain that the ball is gone for good, Scott Hatterberg raises both hands over his head, less in triumph than disbelief. Rounding first, he looks into the Oakland dugout. But there's no one left inside. The players are all rushing onto the field. Elation transforms him. He shouts at his teammates. He's not saying, "Look what I just did." He's saying, "Look what we just did. We won." As he runs, he sheds years at the rate of about one every 20 feet. By the time he touches home plate, he's less man than boy. And not 5 minutes later, Billy Beane was able to look me in the eye and say that it was just another win. Chapter 12. The Speed of the Idea. Billy Beane never allowed himself sentimental feelings about a game or a player or his own experiences. He'd walled himself off from his finer feelings, or tried to. He defined himself by his distaste for, rather than his romance with, his ball-playing past. This set him apart from most people who made their living in the game. Former big league ballplayers usually have friendly ghosts. The sympathy most former ballplayers had for their own professional experiences, for the way they played the game, was nevertheless a problem for the anti-traditional Oakland A's. They needed to employ men with experience, but with that experience came the usual feelings and hunches and instincts. Billy often felt as if he were having to fight the past in his players and coaches, that Paul De Podesta was the only person in the entire organization who drew the same conclusions from the same data as he did. And as the playoffs approached, this problem always intensified. One day before the end of the regular season, Ron Washington and Thad Bosley, the A's infield and hitting coaches, came together in a batting cage just off the visitors' clubhouse in the ballpark in Arlington. Their talk began innocently enough. The team was about to play its second-to-last game of the regular season against the Texas Rangers. Ray Durham was getting in some extra hacks with Wash and Boz looking on, less coaches than connoisseurs. Crack! Wash and Boz were having one last soulful look at Ray Durham before Durham went the way of all of Billy Beane's rent-a-stars. There was little chance Billy would re-sign Ray Durham for next season. There wasn't enough wrong with him. There wasn't anything wrong with him. Durham had what every general manager in the game had always prized. Pop in the leadoff slot, speed on the base paths, and a reputation, less deserved now than 5 years ago, as a good second baseman. In the free market, Durham probably would be overpriced. But even if he was fairly priced, Billy wouldn't keep him. There was nothing inefficient about the market for Ray Durham's services. "Look at Ray," says Wash. Crack. "That little son of a bitch got some juice in that body," says Wash. "He will hurt you, you throw the ball in the wrong place." "Swings like a man," says Boz, "and that man's a menace." "He stands up there like some little Punch and Judy," says Wash, "but he can hurt you." Crack. It's unclear whether Ray is listening to any of this. "You know what impressed me the most about Ray when he first came over?" says Boz. "The way he runs down the first base line." "He's the only base stealer we got," says Wash. "You know what a base stealer is?" I assumed I didn't. "A base stealer is a guy who, when everyone in the goddamn yard knows he's gonna get the bag, he gets the bag." Crack. Wash had been recruited to play baseball by the Kansas City Royals in the early 70s, at a time when the Royals were trying to take track stars and turn them into baseball players. Those Royals had made a fetish of speed, and Wash, a speedster, was the beneficiary. The way Wash tells it, with the first pitch of every game, he and his teammates started running, and they didn't stop until the last. There was sometimes you didn't run, he says, but then he has to think hard about what times those might be. You didn't run on Nolan Ryan, he finally says, because when you ran on Nolan Ryan, all you did was piss Nolan Ryan off. You'd have kept your ass on first base, the hitter might have done something. Not thinking where it might lead, I ask Wash how many bases he stole in his youth. I stole 57 one year, he says. Ray Durham turns slightly and cocks his head in mock amazement. No shit. Wash is looking straight at Ray when he says Boz stole 90. Boz just nods. Ray drops his bat in wonder. You stole 90? He says. Boz just nods again like it's no big deal. Damn. Ray is now engaged. He's like an American tourist who has just discovered the German on the train next to him is a long-lost cousin. It's different here, huh? He says. The question is rhetorical. Ray Durham knows firsthand just how different it is here. 2 months ago, freshly plucked for next to nothing by Billy Beane from the Chicago White Sox, Durham was seated in the dugout before his first game with his new team. The Oakland beat reporters swarmed around him. Their second question was, "How do you feel about Billy Beane putting you in center field?" That was the first Ray Durham had heard of Billy's quixotic plans for him. He hadn't played in the outfield since high school. Durham dutifully said that he was willing to consider anything to help the team, a statement his saucer eyes translated beautifully into a question. Are you fucking kidding me? In nanoseconds, Durham's agent was on the phone to Billy to explain that his client, an all-star second baseman, was a free agent at the end of the year. While happy to perform the usual offensive services for this low-rent team that by some miracle had got their sweaty peasant hands on him for half a season, Ray Durham did not intend to jeopardize his financial future by making a spectacle of himself in center field for the Oakland A's. Ray had an end to that particular stab at baseball efficiency. But when the A's coaches told him to stop trying to steal bases, he had stopped. His whole career, Ray Durham had been hired to steal bases. The moment he arrived in Oakland, his coaches told him to stay put wherever he was until the ball was hit. Billy had traded for Ray not because Ray stole bases, but because Ray had a talent for getting on base, for not making outs. And so for the first time in his career, Ray mostly played it safe on the bases. From the aesthetic point of view, this was a pity. Let Ray Durham do what he pleased on the base paths, and he became a human thrill ride. The other night in Seattle, after a passed ball, he went from second to third in a heartbeat, and then instead of stopping like a sane person, just flew around the bag and headed towards home. The entire stadium suffered a little panic attack. The Seattle catcher dove and spun, the Seattle pitcher felt his sphincter in his throat, and 40,000 Seattle fans gasped like they'd just reached the first crest on a giant roller coaster. A millisecond later, Ray screeched to a halt, trotted back to third, and chuckled. Ray knew how to use his legs to fuck with people's minds. Not running is about as natural to Ray as not breathing, but until now he's bottled up not just his speed, but his feelings. Now, he says, it's different here, huh? Wash snorts. It's the shit, he says. We have 25 stolen bases all year. 8 were guys going on their own and getting it. 10 were 3-2 counts. 7, Art gave the green light. 160 games into the season, Art Howe has given base runners the green light a grand total of 7 times. It's got to be some kind of record. Ray, how many bags you got this season? Asks Wash. 25, says Ray. When he came over, he had 22, says Wash. So he got 3 bags here. 2 of those he took on his own. You run on this team and you're on your own, says Boz ominously. Yeah, says Wash. There's a rule on this club. It's okay if you get it. If you don't, you got hell to pay. That would cast Billy Bean as Satan. Ray shakes his head in wonder and goes back to taking his cuts. Crack! If you say base running isn't important, you forget how to run the bases, says Boz. You want to see something funny? Wash says. Come sit with me in the third base box and watch that shit coming at me. Nobody on this club know how to go from first to third. In addition to being the infield coach on a team that can't afford to waste money on defense, Wash is the third base coach on a team that can't afford to waste money on speed. Whenever a ball goes to the wall, he's required to make these weirdly elaborate calculations to take into account the base-running talents Billy Bean has provided him with. He doesn't want to hear that foot speed is overpriced. Ray can no longer concentrate on his hitting. Cautious doesn't work in the playoffs, he says. Wash and Boz don't say anything to that. Ray's got 3 weeks at most before he's a free agent deciding which multi-million-dollar offer to accept. Ray can say whatever he wants about Billy Bean's approach to baseball. In a few days, the Oakland A's will face the Minnesota Twins in the first round of the playoffs, and all the noise on the television and in the papers is about how the playoffs are different from the regular season. How the playoffs are about manufacturing runs. The playoffs were all about street cred, and science didn't have any. I don't see a lot of playoff games where the score is 8-5, says Ray. It's always 1-0 and 2-1. The fact of it is, says Wash, Billy Bean hates to make outs on the base paths. Ray shakes his head sadly and resumes taking his cuts. I've stumbled upon a revolutionary cell within the Oakland A's, three men who still believe in the need for speed. These aren't stupid men. Ray is obviously as shrewd as a loan shark. Ron Washington can't open his mouth without saying something that belongs in Bartlett's. Boz had succeeded in more than just baseball. After 13 seasons in the big leagues, he'd spent 7 more writing and producing music. Boz had something of the outsider's perspective, which is why Billy had hired him. Boz embraced his unusual role with the Oakland A's, not hitting coach, but on-base instructor. He didn't mind the front office's indifference to batting average. Its indifference to the running game was another matter. Ray was bred on being aggressive running the bases, says Wash. Until he got here, he never got chastised for being aggressive on the base paths. Crack! Ray lines a pitch off the foot of bullpen catcher Brandon Buckley, who has been pitching to him from behind a screen. As Brandon hops around and tries to figure out if he's broken something, Ray turns and says, "The White Sox always told us an aggressive mistake is not really a mistake." Wash is overcome with fellow feeling. Here they have this specimen of base-running prowess, and no one gives a shit. He says, "Ray, what you thinking about when you put the ball in play?" "Second base." "As long as the ball is rolling." "I'm running." "You running?" "A single is a double," says Ray. "A double is a triple," says Wash. Nobody says anything for a minute. Then Wash says, "Different situation here. Somebody on this team runs and get his ass thrown out, and you got all kinds of gurus who tell you that you just took yourself out of the inning." "I never seen anything like it," says Ray. Two things happen towards the end of every season after Billy Bean's Oakland A's have secured a playoff spot. The first was a slightly unseemly attempt by a small handful of staff members to use the newspapers to create pressure on the GM to improve their standard of living. The most transparent of these was an interview given by manager Art Howe to the San Jose Mercury News on the subject of a long-term contract for himself. "With all the years I've been here and with what we've accomplished," he said, "I would think I deserve it. My thinking is if I don't get it here, I'll get it somewhere else." After Art's wife confessed that she, too, was befuddled by Billy Bean's unwillingness to secure their retirement years, Art mentioned how struck he was by how different baseball teams arrange their pecking order. "Down in Anaheim," he said, "all they talked about is the manager. I don't think most people even know who the general manager is down there." The other thing that invariably happened was an unsystematic rethink in the engine room about this quixotic course the captain has set all season long. Coaches, players, reporters, Everyone at once starts to worry that the Oakland A's don't bunt or run. Especially run. Billy Beane's total lack of interest in the stolen base, which has served the team so well for the previous 162 games, is regarded in the postseason as sheer folly. Even people who don't run very fast start saying that you need to make things happen in the postseason. Take the action to your opponent. The atavistic need to run, Billy Beane calls it. The regular season is all but forgotten, but it shouldn't be. Any way you looked at it, it had been a miracle. In all of Major League Baseball, only the New York Yankees won as many games as the Oakland A's. All but written off when they let Jason Giambi leave for greener pastures, the A's had won 103 games, one more than they had the year before. Maybe more astonishingly, at least for economic determinists, the teams in baseball's best division, the American League West, finished in inverse order to their payrolls. Wins, losses, games back, payroll. Oakland, 103-59, $41,942,665. Anaheim, 99-63, games back, 4, $62,757,041. Seattle, 93-69, games back, 10, $86,084,710. Texas, 72-90, games back, 31, $106,915,180. The payroll figures are Major League Baseball's on August 31st, 2002. The wacky funhouse mirror quality of the 2002 season, in which several poor teams made the playoffs and no very rich teams made the World Series, had no discernible effect on Major League Baseball's view of the role of money in baseball success. Commissioner Bud Selig continued to insist that the Oakland A's, who also had turned a slight profit, were doomed. "We're asking them, the Oakland A's, to compete in a stadium they can't compete in," he said in February 2003. "They're not viable without a new stadium." The more money the teams spent on players, at least in the American League West, the less able those players were to win baseball games. The same wasn't exactly true in every other division, but there had been plenty of other astonishing endings. Big budget disasters, the Mets, the Dodgers, the Orioles, and low budget successes, the Twins. In spite of the Oakland A's fantastic success, there was a subtle pressure to change the way they did business. Most of it came from the media. About the 15th time he heard some TV pundit say that the Oakland A's couldn't win because they didn't manufacture runs, Billy began to worry his coaches and players might actually believe it. He printed out the 2002 offensive statistics for the Oakland A's and the Minnesota Twins and sat down with the coaches. The Twins' team batting average was 11 points higher than the A's, and their slugging percentage was 5 points higher. And yet, they had scored 32 fewer runs. Why? Their team on-base percentage was a shade lower, and they'd been caught stealing 62 times to Oakland's 20, and had twice as many sacrifice bunts. That is, they'd squandered outs. "They were trying to manipulate the game instead of letting the game come to them," said Billy. "The math works. But no matter how many times you prove it, you always have to prove it again." The moment the playoffs began, you could feel the world of baseball insiders rising up to swat down the possibility that the Oakland A's front office actually might be onto something. The man who spoke for all insiders was Joe Morgan, the Hall of Fame second baseman, who was in the broadcast booth for the entire five-game series between the A's and the Twins. At some point during each game, Morgan explained to the audience the flaw in the A's thinking. Not that he had any deep understanding what that thinking entailed. But he was absolutely certain that their strategy made no sense. When the A's lost the first game 7-5, it gave Morgan his opening to explain in the first inning of the second game why the Oakland A's were in trouble. "You have to manufacture runs in the postseason," he said, meaning bunt and steal, and in general, treat outs as something other than a scarce resource. Incredibly, he then went on to explain that manufacturing runs was how the New York Yankees had beaten the Anaheim Angels the night before. I had seen that game. Down 5-4 in the eighth inning, Yankees second baseman Alfonso Soriano had gotten himself on base and stolen second. Derek Jeter then walked, and Jason Giambi singled in Soriano. Bernie Williams then hit a 3-run homer. A reasonable person, examining that sequence of events, says, "Whew, thank God Soriano didn't get caught stealing. It was, in retrospect, a stupid risk that could have killed the whole rally." Joe Morgan looked at it and announced that Soriano stealing second, the only bit of manufacturing in the production line, was the cause. Amazingly, Morgan concluded that day's lesson about baseball strategy by saying, "You sit and wait for a 3-run homer, you're still going to be sitting there." But the wonderful thing about this little lecture was what happened right under Joe Morgan's nose as he was giving it. Ray Durham led off the game for Oakland with a walk. He didn't attempt to steal, as Morgan would have him do. Scott Hatterberg followed Durham, and he didn't bunt, as Morgan would have him do. He smashed a double. A few moments later, Eric Chavez hit a 3-run homer. And Joe Morgan's lecture on the need to avoid playing for the 3-run homer just rolled right along, as if the play on the field had not dramatically contradicted every word that had just come out of his mouth. That day, the A's walked and swatted their way to 9 runs and a win, in which Chad Bradford returned to form, pitched 2 scoreless innings. 2 days later in Minnesota, before the third game, Joe Morgan made the same speech all over again. As it turned out, the A's did everyone in baseball a favor and lost to the Twins in the 5th game. In the 5-game series, Scott Hatterberg went 7-for-14 with 3 walks, no strikeouts, a home run, and a pair of doubles. He scored 5 runs and knocked in 3. Chad Bradford faced 10 batters and got 9 of them out, 7 on ground balls. The 10th batter hit a bloop single. Bradford snapped out of his slump after the 20th win. His confidence returned about the same time Scott Hatterberg started telling him what the hitters said on the rare occasions they got to first base against him. After Anaheim's second baseman Adam Kennedy blooped a single off Bradford, he turned to Hattie and said, "Jesus Christ, there's no way that's 84 miles per hour." The 2 games they won, the scores were 9-1 and 8-3. The 3 games they lost, the scores were 7-5, 11-2, and 5-4. These were not the low-scoring games of Ray Durham's playoff imagination, and yet virtually all of the noisy second-guessing after their defeat followed the line of reasoning laid down by Ray Durham and Joe Morgan. One of the leading Bay Area baseball columnists, Glenn Dickey of the San Francisco Chronicle, explained to his readers that the A's don't know how to manufacture runs, which kills them in close games in the postseason. Manager Art Howe, who believed in little ball before he came to the A's, has become so accustomed to the walk-homer approach that he can't adjust in the postseason. In late October, Joe Morgan will summarize the Oakland A's problems in print. "The A's lose because they are two-dimensional. They have good pitching and try to hit home runs. They don't use speed and don't try to manufacture runs. They wait for the home run. They are still waiting." All of the commentary struck the Oakland A's front office as just more of the same. "Base stealing," said Paul DePodesta after the dust had settled. "That's the one thing everyone points to that we do. Or don't. So when we lose, that's why." He then punched some numbers into his calculator. The Oakland A's scored 4.9 runs per game during the season. They scored 5.5 runs per game in the 5-game series against the Twins. They hadn't manufactured runs, and yet they had scored more of them in the playoffs than they had during the regular season. "The real problem," said Paul, "was that during the season we allowed 4.0 runs per game, and during the playoffs we allowed 5.4. The small sample size makes that insignificant, but it also punctuates the absurdity of the critiques of our offensive philosophy. The real problem was that Tim Hudson, heretofore flawless in big games and perfect against the Minnesota Twins, had 2 horrendous outings. No one could have predicted that." The postseason partially explained why baseball was so uniquely resistant to the fruits of scientific research. to any purely rational idea about how to run a baseball team. It wasn't just that the game was run by old baseball men who insisted on doing things as they had always been done. It was that the season ended in a giant crapshoot. The playoffs frustrate rational management because, unlike the long regular season, they suffer from the sample